This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM and webcast at kcrw.com.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
America's worst disaster and the American Red Cross. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Charitable donations in the aftermath of Katrina are unprecedented in American history. More than $1 billion, with three-quarters going to the American Red Cross. But has the Red Cross provided immediate relief for hurricane victims, as mandated by Congress? On To The Point, small-town officials say the Red Cross was nowhere to be found. Was it overwhelmed by the magnitude of the disaster? Did local laws and priorities get in the way? Will the Red Cross reimburse local churches and other charities that stepped in? On Reporter's Notebook later on, getting ready for Rita. First, here's the news.
Support for To The Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To The Point. Out of the record $1 billion in donations for relief from Katrina, three-quarters has gone to the Red Cross. But some local officials say the Red Cross hasn't showed up. On To The Point, was it overwhelmed by the size of the disaster? Will it reimburse other charities that stepped in? On Reporter's Notebook, the evacuation of Texas has traffic backed up for 100 miles. We'll get a report from Houston. First, this news update. Judge John Roberts has been approved by the Senate Judiciary Committee to be the next Chief Justice of the United States. The vote was 13-5, with three Democrats voting for sending his nomination to the full Senate. No Republicans voted against. Judge John Bicknell reports for the Congressional Quarterly. And, John, thanks for joining us.
Sure.
Which Democrats voted for Judge Roberts?
Patrick Leahy of Vermont and the two Wisconsin Democrats, Russ Feingold and Herb Kohl.
How did they explain their votes?
That's a good question. Leahy seemed to spend most of his time explaining why he didn't think Roberts should be confirmed and then voted yes. Feingold and Kohl both essentially deferred to the president, saying that they were not entirely satisfied with Roberts' answers. But and Feingold has done this historically, saying the president has wide latitude to name the people he wants to name.
They're both Democrats from Wisconsin. Does this say anything about politics in Wisconsin?
Well, Wisconsin is sort of what we would call a purple state. It's not real blue or real red, so they might have some concerns. Kohl is, I think you would consider him a fairly safe bet for reelection. Feingold tends to run little closer races, but he's not up for a while.
So here's Leahy, then, from Vermont, saying he's listing, you said, all of the reasons not to vote for Roberts, then turning around voting for him. What transition did he make in that in that syllogism?
Well, he was it wasn't much of a transition. It was a pretty abrupt turn. I think it's safe to say he was laying some groundwork for the next nominee, that he can now turn to the chairman, to Specter, and say, look, I was reasonable on this one, and you need to take a very close look at this next nominee.
Okay, before we get to that, what about the floor vote on Judge Roberts? The Democrats have said they won't filibuster, so is there any chance at all that he might not be confirmed?
No, none. He'll get all the Republican votes, and right now it looks like he'll probably get anywhere between 20 and 30 Democratic votes.
The majority leader, though, Harry Reid, has said that he's definitely going to vote against Roberts. How significant is his position when he's supposed to be the strategy maker for the party?
He went out of his way during his floor speech to say this was a personal decision. He did not want to lead the caucus on this, that everybody should make up their own mind. So I don't think he's going to bring anybody along with him.
He also said, though, that he doesn't think the president is entitled to very much deference. Certainly not going to bring Russ Feingold along with him on that. But what did he mean? That's an unusual thing to hear in the Senate.
I'm sorry. Yeah, it was very unusual, and it might be words that he is sorry he said the next time there's a Democratic president. He might be backing away from that a little bit.
Talking with John McNell, the reporter for Congressional Quarterly. Well, let's then talk about the next nominee to replace, of course, Sandra Day O'Connor. Senator Specter at one point suggested that perhaps the president should wait till the end of the next Supreme Court term in June. Sandra Day O'Connor said she'd stick around that long, but I take it that's not likely to happen.
That's a non-starter. Bush will not go for that.
So what will he go for?
Well, that's a good question. That's the $64,000 question around here. I think what you'll get is somebody who thinks very much like John Roberts, who looks like Sandra Day O'Connor or Clarence Thomas.
Okay. So, in other words, then, an able attorney who's able to deflect questions when they are pointedly asked, but who might be either a minority or a woman.
I think that's a better-than-even bet.
What about the very conservative supporters of the president who are demanding a very conservative nominee? He did, after all, say during his first campaign that Justices Scalia and Thomas were his favorites and indicated he might appoint somebody like them. Does that seem unlikely now?
Well, it's interesting. He didn't do that with Roberts. I think he appointed a conservative but not somebody like Scalia and Thomas. And he will have to make the political judgment whether he wants to send somebody up who he can try to stick down the Democrats' throat, or whether it's somebody more like Roberts.
If he does choose to go for a confrontation, what sort of strategy would we expect from the Democrats?
Oh, I think if you got somebody like, say, the California Supreme Court Justice Janice Rogers Brown, all hell would break loose. You would get a filibuster, and we might get Sandra Day O'Connor staying on the court because that might take months and months.
So then, is it unlikely that the president will do that, particularly given the problems he's having now in other respects?
Well, that's a political calculation. My own feeling is that he's not likely to do that. That he will pick somebody more like Roberts than like Brown.
Which would lead then to the kind of confirmation process we've seen with the Roberts nomination?
Well, I think the Democrats will be more likely to combat it in any case, simply because with Roberts replacing Rehnquist, you had a one-for-one conservative swap. Sending somebody up there to replace O'Connor is going to be very difficult for the Democrats to just step aside. They're going to have to stand and fight, no matter who it is.
John Bicknell, reporter for Congressional Quarterly, thanks a lot for being with us.
Sure thing.
In a moment, America's worst disaster so far and the American Red Cross on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
We're Manali, back with To the Point. The mission of the American Red Cross, as mandated by Congress, is to provide immediate relief in the aftermath of disaster. In the past, there has been a pattern of diverting contributions to other purposes. Red Cross has told Congress that it won't do that again. The response to Katrina has been the biggest outpouring of private donations in history, with three-quarters of the billion-dollar total collected by the Red Cross. But in some places, local officials are saying that the Red Cross did not respond in their time of need. Jeffrey Reed is a city councilman for the city of Bay St. Louis in Mississippi. He is also a pastor. Jeffrey Reed, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you all today.
What has, first of all, what can you tell us about Bay St. Louis and what's left?
Well, Bay St. Louis is, our motto is a place apart, and it's just about that right now. It is a place torn apart. I see, you know, great spirits in the people, great hope in the people. People are rallying together, helping one another, and they're talking about that it's just a setback, and it's a setback for a comeback.
Are you worried about the next hurricane? There's some thought that it may be turning a bit east and that New Orleans now is going to be evacuated. Is that going to be true of your neighborhood as well?
No, we'll probably have some winds off of it, and then in our low-lying areas, we'll probably have a little normal high tide. But besides that, I think we're going to escape it.
Well, what about the Red Cross, and to what extent did it provide assistance in Bay St. Louis at the worst of times?
Well, from my understanding, is that for the first 72 hours, you know, a city is supposed to be able to stand on its own after that. Then MEMA or the state is supposed to kick in, and then after that, FEMA is supposed to kick in. Well, it seemed like basically none of those were prepared to kick in at the right time because nobody knew the extent of this storm. And as far, you know, as the Red Cross, my speaking on the Red Cross, don't want to bash them anything, but, you know, they're here now, but they're late, you know. And I think that's the feeling of a lot of my constituents, a lot of my parishioners that, you know, they did come in, but they're late now. But who has really stepped up to the plate in this particular hour has been churches from around the nation. We've really seen them step in and step up. We have one particular church out of Orange Beach, Alabama, who have been through several hurricanes in the past few years, and they're feeding about 5,000 people per day. And we have another church out of Rome, Georgia, who's feeding approximately 4,000 people a day. And just, you know, the graciousness of America have really, you know, there's a passage of scripture that says there was a gentleman that poured in oil and wine to help the man that was half dead, but yet he was half alive. And I've seen the nation really pour in oil and wine to this community.
Glad to hear that. Back to the Red Cross, though. Do you think that the disaster was sufficiently that the people knew well enough in advance that this was going to happen, that the Red Cross should have been better prepared, should have been on the case sooner than it was?
Well, I think that, you know, all of us should have been better prepared. Nobody knew the magnitude of this storm because, you know, a lot of the old-timers were basing it off of Camille. And I believe that a lot of the people that have lost their lives not as a result of Katrina, but as a result of Camille. And again, back to the Red Cross, I was very disappointed with them and very disappointed with their response. I had one of my parishioners, she called in when she got a chance to get in. She called in, and they said it would be a 10-minute waiting time. Well, make a long story short, she stayed on the phone about an hour and 40 minutes until the phone went dead.
Okay. Again, we're talking with Jeffrey Reed, who is a pastor in Bay St. Louis, Mississippi, also a city councilman there. Laura Howe speaks for the Southeast region of the American Red Cross. She is has just spent 2 weeks in Biloxi, not all that far from Bay St. Louis. And Laura Howe, thanks very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
We've heard this from a lot of different people, not just from Councilman Reed, that the Red Cross was late. Was it late?
Well, you know, are we in every place right now that we want to be? No, we're not. But we're in every place that we can be right now. I think it's important to note a couple of things. First of all, in the five-county Gulf Coast area there along the Mississippi Gulf Coast, we had 21 shelters open before the first raindrop even fell from Hurricane Katrina to provide safe haven to people. You know, we have 9 kitchens that are open, one of which is in Bay St. Louis, that are feeding people. We have 7 financial aid sites that are open across the Gulf Coast area, and we literally had Red Cross trucks rolling in the communities as soon as it was safe to do so after the storm passed. Right now, we've got 70-plus mobile feeding trucks that are in the area. You know, we have a finite number of resources, and I think this storm was bigger than the Red Cross. It was bigger than the federal government. It was bigger than any one group. And so, you know, we really have tried our best, and we've asked for the patience of the people. And most of the people there have been so, so wonderful. You know, we've had wonderful relationships with the churches in the area, you know, with the local city and county governments. And I think everybody's been working together. But this is a storm that, indeed, was bigger than what one organization or one government entity even could possibly respond to. So, you know, I think, again, we were there before the storm hit. We were there with as many resources as we could, but, you know, we do have a fixed number of resources, and, you know, we're trying to cover an area roughly that is 90,000 square miles of disaster-affected area, roughly the size of Great Britain. And so, you know, we are where we can be and where we can get resources in the most centrally located areas on the coast.
Okay, Laura Howe, again, spokesperson for the Southeast Asia region of the American Red Cross. We were scheduled to have Tim Keller, who is the administrator of Hancock County in Mississippi, which is where St. Louis is located. He's apparently talking to the governor at the moment and isn't available to join us, at least not yet. He says this, that the Red Cross, he said, was basically non-existent in his county. We had shelters open, thousands of folks in them, but no Red Cross. Says the Red Cross advertises that it's going to give out vouchers at a certain place. People drive for miles to get there, and then they're told, sorry, we gave out the vouchers. Try again next week. He claims that food distribution was problematic as well, and says that the real help came from the Salvation Army and the various church groups as well. Laura Howe, your response to all of that? I know it's a great litany, but comment on it, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, I think the idea that we've been non-existent is not quite accurate. As I said, you know, we had shelters open pre-landfall. We did have a shelter open in Hancock County pre-landfall of this storm. It wasn't full to capacity, from what I understand. We did have a presence there prior to the storm.
Well, now the county administrator says you didn't. So why do you suppose there's this disagreement?
I'm not real sure why there's a disagreement. We had a shelter open, from what I believe, at the North Central High School was the location that I believe the shelter was open pre-landfall, that was one of our shelters. Now, the county may have opened some shelters on its own, but, you know, there's been kind of a longstanding issue with some of the counties along the coast, because previously they had asked us to place shelters in areas that were in surge zones, and we didn't want to take the risk of our shelter locations flooding and perhaps injuring people. So we wanted to be real careful about that pre-landfall. But, you know, I think, you know, we've served more than 2 million meals in that five-county area post-landfall. We've got the mobile feeding trucks out. We have mental health teams that have literally been walking through the neighborhoods in these areas, talking to people, providing emotional support. We have had, nurses on the ground who have been providing medical care to people. We've been there. And, yes, the financial aid distribution has been problematic, and we've been overwhelmed by the long lines, but we've tried to keep that consistent. Like I said, we have 7 locations that we have open right now where we're doing financial assistance. And we need more people to help us. We need volunteers from the community. If we could get groups of people trained at churches to be able to hand out checks to the community, that would go a long way. So there are some things that we could use some help with as well.
Again, Laura Howe speaking for the American Red Cross. There has been a suggestion that since there was such a massive outpouring of donations, 3/4 of which went to the Red Cross, I presume money is still coming in, that perhaps the Red Cross ought to reimburse some of the churches, the Salvation Army and others that did appear in certain areas where the Red Cross did not. Is there any plan to do that?
Well, let me tell you this. We have raised just over $800 million, okay? And we anticipate that this particular disaster, just Hurricane Katrina, now we're not even talking about Hurricane Rita yet, is going to cost us $2 billion. So we don't even have the resources yet to meet what our anticipated costs are for Hurricane Katrina. In a perfect world, would we like to help provide financial assistance to church groups and things of that nature? Of course we would. But right now, we're trying to meet our own expenses. I mean, nationwide, we have provided 12.6 million meals. So, you know, have we been, you know, has the presence not been what we've wanted it to be in some communities? Sure. But nationwide, over the 90,000 square miles of disaster-affected area, we've had a presence, and we have spent a lot of money. We have provided 2.3 million stays in shelters.
Let me ask you this. In the past, there have been questions raised about diverting money given to for immediate relief to other kinds of things, particularly upcoming disasters. Will any of the money that's been donated for Katrina go to preparing for Rita?
Well, let me put it to you this way. If you're a donor and you tell us that you want your money to be used for Hurricane Katrina, we're going to honor that. We're not going to use it for any other purpose. Like I said, you know, we've raised roughly $800 million, but, you know, we haven't even met the costs associated with Katrina yet. So there's no way that we could possibly be diverting money to any other source at this point.
Okay.
Not that we ever have really in the past, but, we haven't even met the cost of this disaster and haven't even been able to raise that anticipated cost yet. So, yeah, I can tell you that what's being donated for Katrina is definitely being used for Katrina.
Laura Howe, stay with us, as I know you will, till the half hour. George Pienick is our next guest. He's president of the Foundation of the Mid-South, which is based in Jackson, Mississippi. And, Mr. Pienick, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
What's your concern at this point about the first of all, what is the Foundation of the Mid-South? Secondly, what is your concern about the Red Cross?
Well, the Foundation of the Mid-South, we work in Mississippi, Louisiana, and Arkansas, and we work in mostly low-income communities around jobs, education, housing, community development. And as a result, we work in a lot of communities where that are very small, very poor, and that don't have United Way, they don't have any national nonprofits, and not many local ones. And so, and yet, a lot of these communities, the ones closer to the coast, were severely affected by the hurricane force winds, even though they were past the storm surge. And the ones past the hurricane damage received thousands, tens of thousands of evacuees. And, again, it's been said many times on this show, I mean, the Red Cross wasn't there. And that's, again, that's where the churches and the local people really stepped forward. And
over how big an area was the Red Cross not there?
Well, if you look at where the people, I mean, all three states. The governor of Arkansas says there are 50,000 evacuees there. Like when we have money to work with churches and nonprofits in the Delta, which is northwest Mississippi, northeast Louisiana, eastern Arkansas, and we were given $1 million to help those groups, and it's not enough. You know, and again, these are small towns. This is not Little Rock and Jackson and Memphis,
right.
who have their own burdens.
Back to the Red Cross. As pointed out a moment ago, 90,000 square miles, an area the size of Great Britain, was hit by this. Nobody, I think, really anticipated the extent of this disaster. So were there excessive expectations about what the Red Cross might be able to do?
Well, let me just say something, and I say it with full appreciation for what the Red Cross does. I think this was more than just not having enough resources. I think that this was an issue of not having networks and trusted relationships in a lot of poor and low-income communities who are where there's not a large group of sort of middle-class volunteers who tend to do a lot of this work. And I think that's something that, as we look ahead, we have, I would think the Red Cross and any nonprofit, any national nonprofit, we need to really think hard about if they're going to come down and work in an area, are they going to be able to work with the local people and will they have relationships with them, or will they just kind of come in with their own thing and do their own thing alone?
All right. Mr. Pienick, we're running short of time for Laura Howe to be with us, and I want to go back to her and get her to respond to what you have said. Over a large area, once again, Mr. Pienick is saying the Red Cross wasn't there. What about networks? What about relationships at the local level? Is that something that the Red Cross has been lax in developing?
Well, I don't think so. You know, we have a network of chapters all over the United States. We have more than 800 chapters, and those local chapters each go into their own communities and develop grassroots relationships. We also do that when we have a disaster relief operation up and running. And let me just give you one very good example of this. Last week in Moss Point, Mississippi, which is just outside of Pascagoula, we had a community that felt like perhaps they hadn't seen enough Red Cross presence, and so we went to the local church there, St. Paul's United Methodist Church, met with the pastor. His name is Elijah Henry, wonderful man. And they were concerned that we hadn't had enough presence. So we asked them for volunteers. They came up with 40 volunteers that could help us open a check distribution center in that church. Those are the kinds of grassroots things that we do.
Okay, Laura Howe, well, we're going to have to take a very brief break. We'll be right back with To the Point on PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Olney back with To the Point, talking today about the Red Cross and its response congressionally mandated to the Katrina disaster. Its mandate is for immediate relief of disaster victims, and we're hearing from some local people in the area struck by Katrina who were saying that at times when they needed the Red Cross, they didn't feel that it was there. We were listening to Laura Howe, spokesperson for the Southeast region of the Red Cross. And Ms. Howe, I didn't let you finish your point, so go ahead if you will.
Well, I just wanted to address what Mr. Penix said about not being there. Mississippi is a specific example. I think it's a little bit unfair to say that we were non-existent or that we weren't there. We had more than 300 shelters open, and we still have 41 of those open as we speak today, and nearly every single county in Mississippi. I personally worked with a lot of our Red Cross chapters in Mississippi to help them get shelters open and accept these evacuees and make sure that people had the safe haven that they needed, the meals that they've needed. We've served close to 5 million meals in Mississippi. So, we're there providing service. And as I've said before, are we in every single community where we want to be? We're working on that. We really are. But I think it's a little bit unfair for people to characterize it as the Red Cross not being there or not being anywhere in the state of Mississippi, because we certainly have provided a large number of services there.
We have just been joined by Tim Keller, again, who's the administrator of Hancock County, man I mentioned before, who has been in a meeting with the governor. And Mr. Keller, I want to welcome you and just bring you up to speed. I told Laura Keller of the Red Cross of some of your concerns having to do with not enough shelters, with problems getting vouchers, difficulties with food. As you just heard, she said that many meals have been served in Mississippi. She conceded that there have been problems with financial distribution. And as far as the shelters are concerned, she said she thinks there was a shelter in Hancock County at the North Central High School, but that there weren't very many people there. Just interested in your take. And again, thanks very much for joining us.
Yes, sir. Thank you. We and again, my first comments on Red Cross took place within the first week after this disaster. My statements being that Red Cross was basically non-existent in our county, I still stand by that statement. It was at least 4, 5, 6 days into this before we ever even knew we had a Red Cross representative in the county. We had one shelter, and it was in the north end of the county, and it was maxed out. And I'm saying to you, as many folks as we had gone in the arranging days of scheduling that as a Red Cross shelter and the numbers we came up with, we had more people than that there. So the Red Cross shelter that we had was still not being properly manned. And as far as I know, until 3 or 4 days into this, we didn't even know we had a Red Cross representative in our county. Now, my position has changed somewhat. Now they have folks here, but we've still got some other issues with Red Cross. We've got the issues of the word getting out on these vouchers and folks come, and keeping in mind that over half our county was totally covered with water. Most people have lost their vehicles. We're dealing with over 60% of our people that are homeless. They carpool, go to these sites where there's supposed to be vouchers, where there's some relief, get there only to be turned around and say, come back another day. So it's been very frustrating. And to answer and to pick up on someone else's statement earlier, you don't take a crumb to feed a bear, a hungry bear especially. So we've got people here that are destitute, they're desperate. These aren't people that normally rely on the federal government for handout or any other organization such as Red Cross. This happens to be the time where we need assistance, and we need it not just little sprinkles coming along the way. We need assistance for our population here now. So, yes, I'm still frustrated about it.
Back to the question of the shelters. You say half the county was covered with water. Ms. Howe said that one of the reasons that they have not put shelters in some places is that they were in what she refers to as surge zones, which I gather would be Hancock County, and consequently there was a risk of flooding. They didn't think the shelters would be safe. Mr. Keller, your response?
Yes, sir. I'm still with you.
Yeah.
She's exactly right. We were very limited on our shelters that weren't in the zone that could possibly flood. Mm-hmm. But we did have that one, and with that being the only one that we had, certainly I would have expected full attention at that shelter.
So Tim Keller, again, administrator of Hancock County, Mississippi. Back to Laura Howe, and thank you for staying over a bit and responding to what we heard about that first week. What about the 4 to 6 days when Mr. Keller, the administrator, says they didn't know they had a representative of the Red Cross in the county?
Well, you know, there's a Red Cross chapter that is based in Biloxi, Mississippi, and I know that that Red Cross chapter has worked to build some relationships and to make contacts in Hancock County. So, you know, that Red Cross chapter was there before the storm and will be there after. But, you know, I think the point is everybody realizes this was an overwhelming situation as it began. And you know, I think everybody wants to move past any kind of issues that occurred, you know, within the first week or so, and try to focus on what we can do going forward. And what we really need going forward, we need a couple of things. We need people and volunteers to help us on the ground and help us try to open more financial aid centers. And we also need places that are going to be appropriate facilities for that as well, because we know there's going to be large crowds of people that are gathered. So, you know, It would be fabulous if we could find partners in the community that could help us find locations that are appropriate to handle large numbers of people and the traffic and the infrastructure and the issues that brings, as well as volunteers to help us distribute the checks that we're providing to the community, because we want to get this aid out faster, but we need people, we need help, we need resources to be able to make that happen. So, you know, it's not a matter of not wanting to do it. It's a matter of having a fixed number of resources that are available and trying to find resources beyond that right now.
Laura Howe, again, speaking for the Southeast region of the American Red Cross, has been spending a lot of time in Biloxi, Mississippi. Still with us is Jeffrey Reed, city councilman for the city of Bay St. Louis, Mississippi, in Hancock County. Pastor, you have a comment you wanted to make.
Yes, I wanted to make this comment concerning the Red Cross. You know, on the media, you've been seeing mostly New Orleans. You've been seeing Gulfport, Biloxi. But in between New Orleans and Gulfport and Biloxi is cities Bay St. Louis, Waveland, and Pearlerton. And we received, you know, the brunt of the damage. And we, as they said, catastrophic. There's four levels of a storm. There's low, there's moderate, there's high, and then there's catastrophic. We received catastrophic. And when we say that there was no attention given by the Red Cross, there was no attention for the first few days. We basically was on our own. And if we didn't assist ourselves, if we didn't do for ourselves, we had to back trucks up to grocery stores, load the back of our grocery stores up, the products up, drop them off at shelters, because we did open up three more shelters, if not four, after the storm.
Okay.
And, you know, we were the most devastated county in the state of Mississippi throughout this storm.
Councilman Jeffrey Reed of Bay St. Louis. Back to Tim Keller, the administrator of Hancock County. Describe on a little broader base, if you will, the kind of damage that your county sustained. A county of about 46,000 people, as I understand it. How many people are still left?
Well, hard to get a number on that. We've got over 21,000 folks that have already registered needing help with temporary homes. We know that a lot of our folks have left. They had family out of state. Some of them had family where they moved upstate. But we're dealing with almost half of our population, pre-storm population, that's asking for assistance with temporary houses. So we received, I'll say, 21,000 homeowner policies in the county. It's my understanding that there's probably not one that has not filed a claim in the entire county.
Mm-hmm.
Of the claims, well over 60% of them are either total loss or totally out of realism to think about moving back in them anytime soon.
You got any government buildings left?
I have no government buildings left. We've lost all the county buildings. We've lost all the city buildings. And you know, we're certainly not back in a position where we can start offering many of the services for the folks. And that's why I think it's so frustrating when we have just a possibility of getting some assistance, and folks are just, you know, they're just another frustration on top of many others.
Tim Keller, administrator of Hancock County, Mississippi. Peter Dubkin Hall is at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is an expert on nonprofits, has been studying the Red Cross and others as well. And I want to welcome you to our program.
Hi. Glad to be of help.
When we hear about the Red Cross with its now, I guess, $800 million in donations, and we talk in terms of a $200 billion restructuring process in that area, Put it in context. Do you think that people's expectations for the Red Cross are exaggerated?
Yeah, I think they are. But once again, it's very much a matter, as George Penick suggested, of where you're talking about. The Red Cross has a lot, great density of chapters and on the ground capacity in some parts of the country, and not very much in others.
Why?
If you look well, first of all, just let me
sure,
just amplify
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
For the whole state of Mississippi, there are only 6 Red Cross chapters. For the whole state of Louisiana, there are only 7. If you look at North Carolina, you're talking about 30 chapters. If you look at New Jersey, you're talking about 18 chapters. If you look at Connecticut, where I live, which is a tiny little state, it's 13 chapters. So really, it's very underserved, and it's part of a larger problem. And this goes to your why question, and that is that the South has not done much as a region to encourage the development of secular nonprofit organizations. Louisiana is 48th in rank in the number of public charities per 10,000 of population. Alabama is 47th. Mississippi is 50th. So while there are lots of religious congregations and they're very effective, as Pastor Reed says, they can't do the job. And a big national charity like the Red Cross is really unable to act very effectively if it doesn't have infrastructure and organizational capacity on the ground, and it's pretty clear that it doesn't have it in this part of the world.
So are you saying that's because it's unwelcome?
It's not so much that they're unwelcome, it's just that in the American South and a number of other regions, secular nonprofit organizations have not been seen as very central to doing the public's work. Mm-hmm. And now what we're seeing is that when you fail to develop a healthy and diverse nonprofit sector, that when disaster occurs, you don't have the capacity to deal with it.
Peter Duncan Hall at Harvard's Kennedy School. Let me go back to George Penick, the president of the Foundation of the Mid-South, based in Jackson, Mississippi. What's your reaction to what we just heard?
It's like he's been reading my book. One of the hardest things that a foundation has to do is build capacity where none exists. It's easy to make grants when you've got strong nonprofits. When you don't have strong nonprofits, then who do you work with? How do you build that capacity? And in this region, the nonprofit sector, the foundation sector, is just extraordinarily thin. And as he said, especially in Mississippi, right now, a lot of the plans that are being made for rebuilding do not include the nonprofit sector. It's business and the political sector, but the nonprofit sector is not at the table.
Let me go back to Jeffrey Reed, our city councilman for the city of Bay St. Louis, also a pastor in that city. Councilman and pastor, what do you say to this? Has there been a kind of unwelcome mat for secular nonprofits?
I don't think there have been an unwelcome mat. Our state is deemed the hospitality state of the nation, and I believe that, especially, down in our area. I mean, we would welcome that, any kind of help, whether we're in a disaster or not in a disaster. We're just a friendly people. We're just a friendly group of people, friendly city, and I think that statement is unfounded.
But has the state encouraged secular nonprofits in the way that our other guests suggest that it really ought to, if it's going to be able to respond to this kind of thing effectively, suggesting that with all the good work that you and other church people do, you can't do it all?
Well, we have we have a couple of nonprofits in my city and my surrounding area. Bay St. Louis, Gulfport, Waveland, Biloxi have responded very well, to these nonprofits. So that's what I'm saying. I believe that we welcome them with open arms.
Peter Dubkin Hall at Harvard, back to you. It has been suggested that, and I believe Mr. Penick is one who advocates this, that the Red Cross ought to reimburse organizations. I don't know if he means Jeffrey Reed's particularly, but churches and others that stepped in when the Red Cross wasn't there, reimburse them with some of the money that it's collected, some of the $800 million it's collected. Would that be appropriate?
Well, I think that would raise the same kind of problem that happened after 9/11, which is to say, unless donors had specifically designated that the money could be given to other agencies, for example, particularly religious agencies, rather than being used by the Red Cross to provide direct relief, that they'd run into the same kind of criticism of diverting resources and violating donor intent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a nice idea, and if they had the resources, as Ms. Howe said, it would be a nice thing to do. But I think that it's very problematic, you know, just from a legal standpoint. I know that there are probably a lot of donors in the northeastern United States who might not be too happy to see money going to evangelical congregations, even if they were doing good work. So it's problematic. I mean, the Red Cross is normally thought of, and I think most donors think of the Red Cross as an agency to which you give money and they do the work. They don't outsource their work to other organizations.
Mr. Painick, back to you, president of the Foundation of the Mid-South. What about it? Is there a response to what Peter Dobkin Hall said? I know you're going to Washington soon. What are you going to advocate when you get there?
I think the issue is that if national donors, if the default way to give money is to give it to an organization like the Red Cross, they're expecting that money to get down to people who truly need it. And if the institution does not have the infrastructure or the relationships or the policies to be able to work with organizations that can get services to them when they cannot, I think that there needs to be a different way for organizations like the Red Cross to explain their mission, that their mission is not just for their people to do things, but also to get money to people who truly need it. Otherwise, the people who really need it will never get it because there's no way that people outside of the region know the organizations down here that can do the work.
I understand what you mean. I want to change the subject. Back to Peter Dobkin Hall. You were talking earlier about the number of Red Cross chapters in Mississippi, 6, in Louisiana, 7, in North Carolina, 30, New Jersey, 18, Connecticut, 13. What about Texas?
Texas is very underserved as well for its size and population. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but as I recall, it's maybe 15 or 16 chapters for the whole state.
The whole state, of course, being, I think, the second largest, isn't it,
yeah,
in the country in terms of population?
Right. It's a very large state, and it's a very populous state. And I think, you know, it's the same kind of institutional culture that you see in the other Gulf states, which is favored the growth of religious congregations and discouraged the growth of secular nonprofit organizations.
So do you think then that we may see the same pattern in Texas that we have seen in Mississippi?
I would worry that we would. I would worry that we would, yeah. Because once again, it's a situation where there seems to be a lack of capacity on the ground. So that it's all very well to have this wonderful concentration of financial resources that the Red Cross has been able to gather, but unless it has infrastructure and capacity on the ground, it's not going to be able to deploy it as effectively as it might. And I'm not saying this in a way to fault the Red Cross. I mean, you can't make bricks without straw. You can't create voluntary organizations unless people in an area want to volunteer and contribute.
Okay, we're out of time, and I want to thank you all very much for being with us. We're going to look ahead now at what's likely to happen next and what's being done to prepare for it. Peter Dobkin Hall at Harvard, George Painick, Foundation of the Mid-South, Jeffrey Reed, City Councilman and Pastor in Bay St. Louis, Laura Howe with the Red Cross, and Tim Keller, Administrator of Hancock County. Thanks, all of you, very much for being with us today. Well, Hurricane Rita bearing down on Texas. Dropped now to Category 4 with winds of about 150 miles an hour instead of 175. In Galveston, Corpus Christi, and Houston, though, evacuation orders are being taken seriously, and hundreds of thousands of people, maybe even millions or a million, are on the roads. And there have been traffic backups 100 miles long. In a moment, we'll hear about that on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
We're in Olney, back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. With traffic stalling on all the major roads that lead inland in Texas, motorists are running out of gasoline. So the governor, Rick Perry, says the state will try to park gasoline trucks where drivers can reach them.
And again, I urge everyone to exercise patience. I know there's going to be a lot of frustration out there being stuck in the type of traffic gridlock that is even monumental in Houston standards. So this evacuation is historic. in its proportion.
Rick Perry, governor of Texas. Bill Hanna is a reporter for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Bill, I know you were in Galveston yesterday. You're in Houston today. How'd you get there?
Through a very long drive. It took about 5 or 6 hours to get from Galveston to the south side of Houston yesterday.
How long does it usually take?
45 minutes.
Wow. So is the condition on the roads the same as it was yesterday?
I think actually it's worse. I mean, from some of the reports here, some people I've talked to today, it's taken them from the west side of Houston that are trying to get to Austin and San Antonio. They've gone like 12 miles in 6 hours.
So I assume then, see more frustration than patience, to use the governor's words.
Yeah, there is frustration. You know, people are running out of gas. The gas stations in Houston are running out of gas. There's kind of becoming a critical shortfall and a lot of frustration for a lot of people.
Given the fact that there are refineries all along the Texas coast, is that where the gasoline comes from? I think they're shutting down. Does that mean that it's going to be a while before there is gasoline in those areas?
Well, I was also at Hurricane Katrina, and what we saw there, like in places like Baton Rouge, it came back fairly quickly. So I don't know if it's directly the refineries that will be the issue or not. I think that will have a lot to do with the storm damage and where the storm goes. If it goes east of here, you know, they may be back fairly quickly. If Houston and Galveston take a direct hit, it's probably going to be a long time.
Let's talk about Galveston. Tell us about its geographic location. How vulnerable does it seem to this extraordinary storm that's coming that way?
Highly vulnerable. You know, it's probably the second most vulnerable place on the Gulf after New Orleans. You know, a lot of people know about the 1900 storm there that inundated the island and basically it entirely went underwater. If this hurricane was to hit just right, the same thing could happen again. Now, if it takes the track it's going to, that they're projecting right now just to the east of there, that actually might be good news for Galveston, because then it would be on the clean side of the eye and wouldn't take the full brunt of the storm surge.
You say it could be underwater. They've certainly done made a lot of effort to prevent that from happening, with big seawalls and things buried in the sand to try to prevent the surge from going up. And yet, is this storm just so much bigger than what they anticipated? Is that why you're saying that the whole island could be underwater again?
Well, it depends on where the storm goes. Everybody here knows there's a kind of a perfect storm scenario that if the eye were to go a little west of Galveston, which it's not forecast to right now, that would take the storm surge up over the seawall and into Galveston Bay and also flood a considerable part of Houston and all of Galveston County. But that would have to strike just perfectly. Under the current track, that wouldn't happen.
What about the people in Galveston? Do you think there are very many of them who have decided to stick it out rather than evacuating?
Well, a couple hours ago, the Galveston city manager estimated that 90% of the island had evacuated. So, you know, that would leave 10% still there.
And that's roughly how many people?
The island, that probably leaves probably 5,000 or 6,000 people.
Wow. Are they going door-to-door? Are they trying to get them out of there, or are they...
They're not going door-to-door. They basically, you know, it is a mandatory evacuation, but as I understand it, they're not going to kick people out. They're going to suggest very strongly they should leave, but they're not going to physically kick them out.
Bill Hanna, again, reporter for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Well, now you're in Houston. What can you tell us about Houston?
Houston, you're just seeing the staggering effort of how many people are here trying to leave, and what a difficult process that is, you know, that there are so many millions of people in Houston trying to leave, and what kind of strains that's putting on the roads and the infrastructure and things like gasoline. Where I am right now is on the south side of Houston. It's actually sort of calm here because this part of the city, I think, is largely evacuated. But north of here, it's chaos, and people are trying to leave and obviously having a very difficult time doing it.
How many people do you think we're talking about that are actually trying to get out of there?
You know, the estimates have been anywhere from, you know, 800,000 to 1.2 million. I don't think anybody has a clear number on that, but I think obviously it's at least that much by what's happened on the roads and the difficulty people are having getting out.
I take it nobody is suggesting at the moment that in the aftermath of Katrina anybody's overreacting.
I don't know about that, but earlier this morning, the Brazoria County judge, which is the county on the coast just to the west of Galveston County, was critical of the Houston mayor and county judge for suggesting more people from Houston leave, saying that it was making it harder for his people to leave. So there have been some flare tensions between officials down here.
You mean his people are closer to the coast, more likely to be in the path of the hurricane?
Exactly. And the evacuation plan, as it was supposed to work, was the coastal people obviously evacuate first, but they all have to come through Houston, and then you'd have the people from Houston leave. But obviously, as with the time it's taking, you know, those people were still trying to get out when they told people in the flood-prone areas of Houston to leave as well.
Well, maybe some people in Houston took it upon themselves to get out even before they were ordered.
Exactly. Absolutely. And that's what a lot of people are saying is causing a lot of the gridlock, is a lot of those people decided to leave.
Do you see a lot of military people around?
No, there's not a large contingency of military. From what I understand, they will stage once the storm hits. But you're not seeing military vehicles or anything like that. I don't know if you're starting to see that on Galveston or not, but you're not seeing that in Houston at all.
A lot of police visible?
The police are very visible, and they're all being told, you know, they've got to stay. We talked to some police officers this morning who, you know, said they'll actually be riding out the storm in their substations, and as soon as the winds go down, they'll be back out on the streets.
When these people evacuate, maybe as many as 1.2 million, as you indicated, where are they going?
They're going really in all directions. You know, all the freeways out of Houston are gridlocked. They're going north to Dallas and to Fort Worth. They're going west to San Antonio and Austin, and even some are going back towards Louisiana.
Maybe not a good idea if the storm is moving in that direction. Are those places, are those cities ready to take them?
You know, the latest reports we've heard are the nearest hotel rooms are in Oklahoma City. So that's how far people are having to drive if they don't have family or if they aren't going to stay in a shelter.
And are officials at this point staying calm, or do they appear to be pretty nervous about what's going on?
I think they're calm. They're saying, you know, that despite the lengthy times, that this is going as planned. Under their models, they were saying it would take 30 to 36 hours to evacuate this area. They're still in that window. Now, if we're still in the situation tomorrow, I'm sure it'll be a different story.
All right, Bill Hanna, but we wish you luck and all the other people down there as well. And thanks a lot for talking to us.
You bet.
Okay, reporter for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Karen Ranziner and Jonah King, technical director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warman Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.